You may be familiar with the reality show that runs on, of all channels, the History Channel. I'm thinking of the reality show that is known by the title of Pawn Stars. That's Pawn, P-A-W-N, Stars. It's a series surrounding a Las Vegas pawn shop that has been in operation for three generations. In a recent episode, someone walked into the pawn shop with a violin and a story. A violin and a story. As the story goes, the person in possession of the violin explained that he had just bought some property on which was located a house, and inside the house there was this chest. As the man looked in the chest, he found this violin in pristine condition with the exception of a bit of dust. And when the man dusted the violin off, lo and behold, on the violin was inscribed the words, Stradivarius. Stradivarius. And of course, as you know, a Stradivarius violin in any condition is worth a pretty penny. And so this man assumed that having found this Stradivarius in such good condition, well, this was better than a winning lottery ticket. And so he took the violin into the pawn shop in order for the pawn shop to give their judgment as to the worth of this Stradivarius violin. Pawn shop owner looked over the violin and saw that it was in good condition and thought that it made sense to have the violin appraised by a true expert. And when the report came back, as you would have guessed, that Stradivarius violin was a cheap imitation that had been constructed sometime during the early 1900s. It was worth around $500, which is no amount of money to sneeze at, but nothing like what the man hoped he had possessed. Instead, all he had was, for all intents and purposes, a relatively cheap imitation as real value goes. But what gripped me was what the owner said in response to the man's hopes that perhaps he was in possession of a real Stradivarius. The pawn shop owner said to the man these words: just because something has a label does not mean that it is the real thing. Just because something has a label, it does not mean that what you have is the real thing. We all know that pretty much everything in life is subject to some form of imitation. I remember some years ago, I could not afford Ping golf clubs. So I went down to Edwin Watts and purchased the best knockoffs that I could buy. They looked like Pings, but they weren't really Pings. I bet some of you made a purchase like that at some point in your life. You know how in business there are things that are subject to imitation. You know how in politics there are things subject to imitation. There is no part of life really that is spared from these cheap imitations, including our faith. I remember some years ago, back when bumper stickers were popular. Do you remember that time? We don't need bumper stickers anymore. We have social media. We have Facebook and Twitter. So if someone wants to make a statement, that is the new bumper. But once upon a time, if you wanted to offer social commentary, you found you a sticker and you affixed it on the back of your car bumper. And there used to be some real doozies. One that I saw that I always had to scratch my head over was the bumper sticker, obviously affixed by a Christian person, a bumper sticker that read, "Jesus is coming, look busy." Really? I mean, that's what we're supposed to do? Jesus is coming, look busy? Sad truth is that there is a lot about faith that really isn't genuine, because it is a faith that is lived pretty much at surface level. Looks good. Looks good. And it sounds good. But you scratch beneath the surface, and there's really not much there. If only we realized that one day we will stand in the presence of our Maker. One day we will stand in the presence of our Savior and our Lord, and we will give on that day an account of our faith, and we will be judged. We will be appraised as to the genuineness of our devotion. Such were Paul's words to the church at Corinth in his second letter, which comes across as an apology, not as, "I am so sorry if I offended you," but in the classic sense of the word, an apologia, a defense of his calling. Hard for us to wrap our minds around Paul having to defend his calling to become a minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ, because for us he is, outside of Jesus, such a central figure of our faith, responsible for the vast majority of the New Testament. But in Corinth, there came a season in which people in the church weren't entirely sure about Paul's motivations. You know, he talks an awful lot about money. Talks an awful lot about money. And he talks an awful lot about himself. And, you know, I'm not sure that Paul is in his right mind. I mean, at times he just doesn't seem as if he's playing with all of his marbles. And so Paul has to write this letter to defend, not himself, but to defend Jesus and the work that Jesus has done, is doing, and will be doing in his life. And so he says to the church, look, if you think that we are out of our mind, it is for the sake of God. And if you think we're in our mind and we make any sense, that's for your sake. But I want you to know, Paul says, that what drives me is not money. And what drives me is not personal commendation. It's not about me. It is the love of Christ that compels me. That's what Paul says. It's the love of Jesus that compels me, because we're convinced. I mean, this is not a matter of opinion. I am persuaded at the core of my being that Jesus died. We've all died. But if we give our lives fully and completely to Him who died for us and was raised again to life, what a driving force that is. And the genuineness of our devotion is all grounded in what we see God having done for us in the person of Jesus. Paul convinced that if God spared nothing for us and for our salvation, and in Jesus giving His all for us at Calvary, how then can we represent ourselves as His followers if we are not willing in response to give our all in return to Him? As you look at your life and your faith, as you scratch beneath the surface, is there something genuine there? Is there something that reflects the devotion of the entirety of your life, everything that you are, everything that you have, because you are compelled by God's love in Jesus Christ for you? Are you familiar with the name Walker Percy? If you are a person who loves literature, you know that name, an award-winning Southern author. He's associated with Louisiana, but did you know that Walker Percy was born in Birmingham on the West End? And virtually all of Percy's novels reflect a spiritual bent. They're secular novels. They're not novels that are intended to underscore in a very obvious way religious and spiritual themes. But when you scratch beneath the surface, they're there. They're there. In one of his novels, which is titled The Second Coming, it's a story about a man named Will Barrett who is remarkably wealthy. I mean, Will Barrett, by all appearances, he's got it made. Nice house, nice car, extravagant lifestyle. But underneath, he's empty. He's empty. There's nothing there. And at one point in the book, as Will Barrett is trying to work through all of his family dysfunction and all of his faith dysfunction, in the midst of all of this affluence, he's sitting in the driveway of his 5-car garage in his top-of-the-line Mercedes. And he's just feeling so empty. And he spots a cat lying in the driveway. A cat who's just sunning. You know how cats do. They get out in the sun and they soak in the rays of the sun. And Barrett sees this cat lying in the sun. And Barrett thinks to himself, now that cat is 100% cat. That's what cats do. And that cat is 100% cat. And Barrett begins to ask himself the question, am I 100% about anything in my life? Anything? Am I 100%? Are you 100% about anything in your life? Anything? Be careful how you answer that question. Because whatever it is in your life about which you are 100%, that thing, that passion, that love, that loyalty, it is your God. It is your God. And as Paul looks at his life, he says, I'm 100% about Jesus because I am just compelled, driven, moved. I love the old King James word. We don't use it enough. I am constrained, Paul says, by the love of Christ who died and was raised to life for me. Paul is saying to the church, listen, listen. We all want to experience meaning and purpose in life. We all want our lives to count. We all want our life to have an impact, no matter how much we are able to accumulate in life. All of that is not able to provide us with the underlying purpose. We need to be changed. We need to be transformed. We need, as you read later verses in the fifth chapter, we need to become new creations. New creations. And the only thing that will bring about the radical transformation that will enable us to live life at a higher level is our commitment to the love of Jesus, who himself committed his all to us. Paul is writing this letter to invite believers in Corinth and believers in Mountain Brook to join him in giving all for Jesus, in holding nothing back, in being a person who is fully and completely committed to God's kingdom purposes in Jesus, for only those purposes will afford us the quality of life here on earth and the life eternal in heaven that all of us so desperately long to know. James Howell is the pastor of the Myers Park Methodist Church in Charlotte, North Carolina. If you know anything about Charlotte and Myers Park, it's an area that's an awful lot like Mountain Brook. Highly educated people, highly successful people, highly accomplished people. People who are at home in Mountain Brook would feel right at home at Myers Park. He tells a story in one of his sermons about how on a vacation, this tells you a lot about Myers Park, the pastor of the church took his family on vacation to London. So they're on vacation in London and they're riding the train and they're seeing the sights of London and his wife and his girls. And they're trying to pass the time and so Howell says, I start asking them questions just as a way of getting them out of the boredom of the train ride. And so he asked them questions like, well, can you tell me the first lines of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address? Can you tell me who comprised the second triumvirate? Can you count to 10 in Spanish? Can you name the books of the Bible? And all of a sudden, Howell says there was another person on the other car. He was kind of listening. He was kind of listening to what Howell was doing with his kids. And when he got to the question, can you tell me the books of the Bible? The man kind of got to the edge of his seat and he stood up and he says, sir, are you a Christian? Are you a Christian? And Howell said, you know, it was a different kind of question than what you get in America with the pamphlet pushers. It's at a very deep level. Are you a Christian? Almost an urgency, as if the man was constrained, compelled. Are you a Christian? Hal said, yes, yes, I am. I'm a Christian. What kind of Christian are you? The man asked. And Hal thought to himself, you know how these thoughts just go through your mind 1,000 miles a second. What am I going to say? Am I going to say I'm a Chalcedonian Orthodox Christian? Am I going to say I'm a generously Orthodox kind of Christian, a la Brian McLaren? Am I going to say that I am a cynical on Monday kind of Christian? I mean, you know, he's sort of thinking. Finally, he decides to keep it simple, and he says to the man, I'm a Methodist. And the man said, almost as if Howell has said something, you know, that is just the worst thing in the world that could be said. Methodist, the man said. Oh, here in England, Methodists don't take their faith seriously. It's all pretend. It's all for show. It's a social thing. Howell, of course, feeling defensive, said, well, that's not the case in America, at which point his wife and kids start laughing. Well, that's not the way it is in America. We're serious about our faith. And then Howell says, what kind of Christian are you? Reasonable question, when you think. What kind of Christian are you? The man says, I'm a gypsy Christian. Howell said, a gypsy Christian? He said, yes. I'm a gypsy Christian, and you need to know that here in England and across Europe, the gypsy church is booming. It's booming. Everything else, it's dying. In every other church, it's nothing but a museum. But in England and France, Germany, Italy, the gypsy church is booming. Do you know why it's booming? And Howell said, before I could hazard a guess, the man told me. He says, because as gypsies, our primary profession is fortune telling. So that when a gypsy becomes a Christian, he can't tell fortunes anymore. He has to find a new way to make a living. Howell said, I said it. I was embarrassed when I said it. Well, couldn't you fake it? And the man looked at him and he said, absolutely not. Because when you tell fortunes, you dabble in the occult. And when a person becomes a Christian, that way of life is no longer an option. To become a Christian as a gypsy, you have to give up a lot. Hal said, wouldn't you know it, that time, doors to the train opened and everybody got out, and I gathered my wife and my girls and we left the car, but that conversation just kept ringing over and again in my mind. In America, what professions are there that followers of Jesus have to surrender? What patterns of behavior do they have to sacrifice once they follow Jesus? Is there any reason other than this total and complete dedication? Is there any reason for the gypsy church all over the world to be booming while the rest of us, even in America, even in Charlotte, as Christians, we find our churches struggling? Do you want to see the church boom? Well, we can't speak for every other church. We speak for this church. We can speak for this church. Do you want to see this church boom and grow and develop and reach people and become a place where God's presence is palpable and people respond to it because we are under constraint. The love of Jesus compels us. Then speak we must, not just with our lips, but with our lives. And speak we must today, this moment, this hour, because brothers and sisters, Jesus is coming. He is coming. He's coming to judge the genuineness of our devotion. And it's not going to be enough for us as Baptists to do what we do best, look busy. It's not enough. It's not enough. We must live with all that we are and with all that we have. And we must respond with grace and generosity to all that Jesus has done, is doing, and will be doing for us. Jesus is coming. And until that time comes, when we stand in His glorious presence, the best thing that we can do is not to look busy. The best, the holiest thing that we can do is to look faithful. That's it. Every day, look faithful.